The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 132 of The Bugle, the Sistine Chapel of audio newspapers, in that it is full of lies and doesn't look or sound as good if you've got your head clamped inside a metal box and it isn't as popular as reality TV. I am, why should I tell you, let me live my own life. And in New York, it's the freshly crowned International Hesitator Magazine's Indecisive Bagel Tutor of the Year 2010. He once took 2 hours 18 minutes to pick a bagel for lunch before finally plumping for the same one he always has. It's John Oliver.
If it's worth eating, it's worth choosing right, Andy. Hello, Andy.
Hello.
Hello, Buglers. Well, Andy, how do you... The Bugle's now in its fourth year.
Yeah, that's right, mate.
How do you feel about yourself after last week, Andy? You got anything you want to say? Not necessarily to me or to the Bugles, but to yourself, Andy.
What?
Anything you got to say to yourself? Because after you did the last episode of the Bugle, about... It's a conservative estimate, about 9 times over the legal alcohol limit for podcasting. I think we should just get one thing clear straight away today. What substance are you under the influence of for this episode, Andy? Will this be the first Bugle where you're borderline blacked out on heroin? Or will we be hearing what Andy Zaltzman is like on mescaline? Or would you rather that just we all just guessed?
Oh, well, you can guess, but... you can't guess. It's I'm just high-class tea this week.
The fact that
got a lovely Yunnan going.
The fact that you were not only drunk, but drunk on sherry. I mean, that is some premium grade Britishness, right there.
I was not drunk, John.
Yes,
I was not fully
you were
drunk.
Sozzled, Andy.
I just had one glass. Well, two glasses.
I didn't say how many glasses you had. I said that you were smashed.
Well, if you think I was drunk then, John, you should have seen later in the evening when obviously the festivities continued and Well, suffice it to say that I ended up in Trafalgar Square in just a string vest and Y-fronts, being airlifted off the top of Nelson's Column in a Times Online helicopter. While I was trying to get Nelson to give me a piggyback while shouting, "Giddy up, Admiral, giddy up, I've got things to do. I don't care how few arms and eyes you've got." But I'm never drinking Madeira wine again, John.
if you're drunk on sherry, you shouldn't be doing a podcast. You should have been challenging me to an 80-day race around the globe. Also, Andy, my throat is shot because that's basically what my body is saying to me at the moment, Andy. I've been on a road trip this week. We've been shooting pieces about the kind of people who are coming to the Daily Show rally next week on a bus. And I have to say, there are some impressively weird places on the back roads of America. I don't want to spoil any details of these pieces until the next Bugle, in case anyone sees them next week. But I will say this, you haven't lived until you fired a T-shirt cannon at a police car. I'll just say that. That's a little teaser.
That's what, roughly what Lee Harvey Oswald thought he was doing.
That's right. Just got out of hand.
Yeah, he just got hoodwinked.
Well, it's a pretty small T-shirt, this.
It's falling very hard. I guess it expands on contact.
And you say the wind will take it away from the president's car into the police car. Okay, you're the expert. Bang.
No, they gave me the hat. So it's the week beginning Monday, the 25th of October, 2010. That's what this Bugle is for, which means, of course, that the very second you listen to this, it will be the 595th anniversary of the Battle of Agincourt. It's amazing to think, John, that if we'd lost that battle, then today everyone in Britain would be speaking with a slightly French accent. And the Queen would be wearing a baguette on her head. So.
Yep.
Upon such slender historical threads, John.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
Henry V, of course, won that battle, the original Mr. October. was known as the... well, before Reggie Jackson did it. He was known as the inventor of the... And I think that's probably the first joke in which Henry V and Reggie Jackson have coexisted.
I think you might be right.
Best known as the inventor of the pudding bowl haircut and the first Englishman to rap to his troops before a battle. That was at the Battle of Shrewsbury in 1403. Which famously portrayed in Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 1 or 2, I can't remember. Henry Percy gonna beg for mercy. Harry Hotspur, he will not survive. He also managed to rhyme Welsh with squelch. The curtain raiser for the Battle of Agincourt, the Siege of Harfleur, Henry famously gave his pre-match speech, paraphrased famously by the prominent historical documentary maker William Shakespeare, the old once more into the breach, dear friends, once more stiffen the sinew, summon up the blood, etc., etc.
Classic.
As they said, etc., etc., that's how they finished it in a very brief production I once saw. Shows you should never schedule a play to clash with the World Snooker Final, because the actors will just rush through it, John, to get back to their dressing rooms to watch it on telly.
Rightly so.
I'm certainly pretty sure that play was not supposed to finish, yippee, we won, take that Frogland. But then Agincourt, he rather ran out of inspiration. And his follow-up pre-match speech, Agincourt, was, same again, please, lads. Get out there and give it 110%. Some of you are going to die, quite painfully as it happens, but we could really do with another W here, fellas, so get stuck in. I'll be in the HQ tent if anyone needs me. Cheerio. And also happy birthday to Pablo Picasso, 129 today, and to the pro wrestler Too Cold Scorpio, and to the Nazi war criminal Klaus Barbie. All share the same birthday. Read into that what you will. As always, a section of Bugle's going straight in the bin this week, indoor ecology. Now, we're all familiar with the environment these days, but did you know that you could have a bit of the environment in your own flat or house? We tell you how to turn your living room into a ploughed field ready to sow some crops. All you need is a lorry load of soil and a plough. Also, did you know that whenever you have a nice hot shower, you're basically a small bit of rainforest, with you as a tree and your feet as the undergrowth? So why not accessorise with a rare species of jungle bat and some poisonous snakes to keep you on your toes, and more importantly, to get you in and out of that shower ASAFP, thus saving water and, more importantly, the planet, and even more importantly, some money. Plus, we tell you how to turn yourself into a human wind turbine. Simply construct a simple generator out of elastic bands and some kind of basic motor, attach it to your shoulder, and then spend the whole day windmilling your arms like a forgetful Pete Townsend trying to end a song. And you could generate enough electricity to electrocute an unwanted neighbourhood cat. That section is in the bin.
Top story this week, Britain cuts back to the 19th century. Andy, the UK spending review was released this week, and the conclusion was essentially that we shouldn't do it anymore. No more spending. Absolutely no more spending. Let's just return to the grand old days of bartering with sheep that we actually had, not with derivatives of sheep that we'd purchased from a Taiwanese shepherd that we'd never met before. The review also seems to reach the conclusion that we've become addicted to spending in the UK and that we should now go into a recovery programme to kick the habit. The problem is, however, that to do that, we also need to give up things that could tempt us back to our old ways, like compassion and other gateway emotions. We need to give up our weaknesses like compassion or community or basic human respect for one another and do it completely cold turkey for this economic programme to work. It was up to George Osborne to break the news to the British public, and he probably should have started his speech by asking everyone to sit down first and then pushing a box of tissues towards the population saying, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. The good news is that I found half a Twix in my desk drawer this morning. Now here's the bad news. At which point he'd unfurl a comically long scroll that would roll down the centre of the Houses of Parliament and out into the street and then clear his throat and start to read.
Well, that didn't happen, of course. What did happen is that the House of Commons official announcer bawled out the words, Deficitageddon, it'll probably be okay. Then Osborne walked into the House of Commons in a black cape with a pretend set of Dracula fangs to the backing music of a hip-hop version of Cat Stevens' First Cut is the Deepest, vaulted over the dispatch box, stripped down to his pinstripe boxer shorts, put on an Olivia Newton-John wig and sang, let's get fiscal, fiscal, I want to get fiscal, let's get into fiscal. And then he began his announcements. So that's what actually happened.
It's, I mean, just the highlights or the lowlights of this absolute catastrophe is, one of the standout figures, welfare spending, is going to be cut by a further £7 billion than the last budget. 490,000 public sector jobs will be shed over the next 4 years. Government departments will have their budgets cut by 19% on average over the next 4 years. And the police budget is being reduced by 20%. Osborne started his speech saying that today's the day when Britain steps back from the brink, when we confront the bills from a decade of debt. He sure knows how to fire up a crowd, doesn't he, Andy? There's nothing people like doing more than confronting their debt. That's why people spend so long staring longingly at their unopened bank statements. To which all of this, the Shadow Secretary, Alan Johnson, replied, it is our firm belief that the rush to cut the deficit endangers the recovery and reduces the prospects for employment in the short term and for prosperity in the longer term. Before continuing, It is also our firm belief that it is f***ing great not to have to do this ourselves. We picked the perfect time to not be in office. Good luck dealing with this. Seriously, good luck with it. If you need us, we'll be relaxing over there, waiting for the public to gather outside the Houses of Parliament with pitchforks.
Yeah, the extent of the cuts was interesting. It wasn't the promised 25% or even the 40% hinted at. It was a barely noticeable 19%. And as Osborne pointed out at the end of his speech, this was actually less than the 20% that Labour had pledged during the election campaign. And making this point, he and the entire Tory front and back benches laughed uproariously at the thoughts of only a barely noticeable million people losing their jobs. Very much the reaction of a group of people who have never lost a job, largely through never really having one, never had to take a benefit, never had to worry about how to pay for food or clothing or basic survival. But still, very good political point, well scored. And let's not forget with those jobs, John, that half a million in the public sector, roughly half a million in the private sector. But the private sector is magic, John, and Muriel, the magic private sector, will spring into life at this point and give absolutely everyone a brand new job. So it's all going to be fine. I mean, I've written a book about economics, John. I know this.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. If you don't know, who
does?
That's
how it works.
It is very strange to be so proud of this. It's like a mugger bragging that they only broke 14 of your bones when another mugger might well have murdered you, and then asking you to thank them for that rather than being an ungrateful little shit.
But it's very hard to know exactly how this will pan out, John, because on the one hand, you've got the government and their supporters who say it's going to work, it's fair, and it will make the economy better. Mm-hmm. Yep. And on the other hand, you've got the opposition and their supporters who say it won't work, it's not fair, and it will make the economy worse.
Mm.
So one of them has to be wrong.
Yeah, it's
and,
tricky.
Maybe they're both wrong.
Very tricky.
Maybe
also, there's huge cuts in defence spending in Britain. So if you do want to invade Britain, if you're thinking about it, now really is the perfect time. The leaves are turning, the weather is mild, conkers are on the ground, and we are completely defenceless.
Well, actually, you'd probably want to wait till the conkers have gone, because I mean, that's your first line of defence as a Brit.
Well, yeah, it could cause havoc with tank tracks, couldn't it?
Well, you just hurl a conker at someone, they're going to run away.
Osborne tried to sweeten this cyanide pill by saying, the alternative to this is ruin. That's not accentuating the positive, Osborne, that's threatening people with Armageddon. That is terrible, terrible parenting. It's like saying to a child, eat your greens or I will personally kill your pet rabbit. They need to spin something positive out of this unremitting misery. Don't say, we're cutting police funding by 20%. Say, hey, late night walks through the park are going to get a lot more exciting. Don't say education budgets are going to be slashed. Say, guess what? You're cleverer than your kids again. He did try to put a silver lining on this complete pile of shit while he did admit that half a million public sector jobs are under threat, he emphasised that headcount could be cut by natural wastage rather than openly talking about redundancies. Do bear in mind that natural wastage could be referring to the wastage of actually paying people money in return for them completing regular tasks in a professional workplace. Or in layman's terms, f***ing sacking people. Osborne even tried distraction at one point by pulling out a box full of kittens and letting people watch them adorably jump over each other while he mentioned in an extremely quiet voice that he'd be decimating the budget for legal aid. And to his credit, that did seem to work pretty well.
But it's going to be the ultimate testing ground for big society, John, because that's going to have to step into all the gaps, this big society scheme that no one understands. It's the perfect political policy, John, that the Conservatives have unveiled and shoved down this country's throat. Big society, because it's two words long, and everyone understands what each of those words means independently. But if you put them next to each other, no one has the faintest fucking idea what they're on about.
That's the skill, isn't it? Yeah. That is the genius.
I think basically, if you're not happy with your kid's school, then all you need to do is found, build, staff, and administer a new school. I mean, it is as simple as that.
If you're free to do it,
and if you're not happy with military funding, you set up your own local militia group and find your own local wars.
Yeah,
I believe. Around my part of London, there seem to have been some pilot schemes running in this anyway. If people in your local area think Robert Mugabe should be deposed, or Ahmadinejad, or
Sarkozy or yeah. Sepp Blatter, then you just club together, you form your own little fighting force, you go over there and you depose them yourselves. Why, John? Why must it always be central government that is responsible for regime change?
They're empowering the British public, and is that a crime?
Osborne, he said in a recent interview that welfare cheats were like muggers who robbed taxpayers of billions of pounds a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think you should say that, John, because we did a sketch in our long-forgotten radio series.
Long-forgotten.
The Department, in which we suggested that large-scale corporate tax evaders were like muggers who robbed the taxpayers. Well, I guess that's just two sides of the same coin.
Exactly.
And these billions of pounds that these welfare cheats are robbing should rightly be robbed by high-level corporate tax evasion instead. And that's what Britain was built on.
As you say, Andy, the two parties unsurprisingly disagree as to whether this is the correct approach or not. The Shadow Secretary to the Treasury said, "I don't think there's any way that a Labour government would have made choices that mean that children are actually bearing more of a burden in this deficit reduction than bankers." To which the Conservative response was, "Oh, I'm sorry, are children being sent up chimneys? Answer the question. Are children being sent up chimneys? Are they? Exactly. So they should consider themselves very lucky to have gotten off f***ing lightly."
Well, this is the argument is that if you make bankers pay more, they will simply relocate overseas and taking their money and their money with them, and also their money. But it would be nice, wouldn't it, if the bottom 30% earning people in Britain just all simultaneously relocated overseas on the same principle. Yeah. If you want us to pay more, we are off.
This is also a very awkward situation for the Liberal Democrats to be in, as they're, of course, part of this coalition government, and their fingerprints are all over these vicious cuts to vital public services. Nick Clegg has defended this by apparently writing to his MPs, explaining, "Our values and priorities are written through the spending review like the message in a stick of rock." But only if that stick of rock features the message, "Go f*** yourself."
And bear in mind, most sticks of rock end up half-eaten under the front seat of a car after a disappointing day out at the beach.
That's what happens to you, Messi. Is that all chipping a tooth? The retirement age will also be pushed up to 66, and people in Britain have taken this with a stoic shrug, essentially, which is impressive considering that France has basically been up in flames all week over plans to raise the age to 62 and make them work more than 3.5 hours a week or something.
Bugle feature section now, and national identity. And, well, John, you must feel pretty strongly about this, having abandoned your nation in its hour of need. Like the
certainly,
turncoat traitor that you are.
It's certainly looking like a better and better decision, Andy. Little did I think I was the mortar that kept Britain together. But, I think it's more Russell Brand leaving that has caused a real dent in the tax revenue.
But it's a big thing, national identity. Of course, politicians always crapping on about it when they need to. And we've seen this in Israel recently. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is slightly backtracking on a bill that previously had required only non-Jews to swear loyalty to Israel as a Jewish state when taking Israeli citizenship. And it hasn't gone down too well with the human rights lobby. Israel clearly thought to itself, hang on, we haven't provoked international outrage for a wee while. Let's just keep our hand in by making non-Jews pledge allegiance to a Jewish state. The oath includes pledges, quotes, not to see other countries behind Israel's back, to growl during all non-Israel national anthems, and to eat and or think about pickled herring at least once a week, and also to be pretty easygoing about building regulations. do you have to swear an oath when you wake up every morning in America, now that you're an American? Or?
I do, but the only oath I swear is, "F*** yeah!" It's broad, but it's positive.
Right, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Did you have to do it when you got your green card? Do you have to have an official "f*** yeah"?
Yeah,
what did you have to say when you got your green card?
Is that, Andy, you have to put your hand on your heart and say "f*** yeah." That's it.
Right. That's Thomas Jefferson was quite into that, wasn't he?
He loved it.
Yeah.
It was his idea. Other national identity news now, and Fiji has admitted losing the legal document confirming its independence from the United Kingdom, Andy. Oh, boy. As Fiji celebrated the 40th anniversary of winning independence from us, its government admitted it had lost the independence order presented to ministers by Prince Charles in 1970. Well, whoopsie-daisy. In that case, happy un-40th independence birthday, Fiji, and let me be the first to welcome you back to the British Empire. Why do you think that the Americans are so careful with their copy of the Declaration of Independence? Because they know that if they ever lose it, and they can't get in touch with Nicolas Cage to get it back for them, then there is a team of British lawyers ready to recolonise their asses before their feet hit the f***ing floor.
The problem is they kept it in the same drawer they keep their takeaway menus in. And, well, the one just got covered in...
That is unwise.
...in pizza and clearly got thrown away. Well, Fiji, of course, primarily famous for ludicrously flamboyant rugby. And for being the nation that provided the setting for every single film script ever written by the long-lasting pop legends The Bee Gees. What do you mean you don't want to make the film, Weinstein? Said the Gibbs brothers every year. The title fucking rhymes. What more do you fucking want? You've made Herman's Hermits German Permits, a screwball comedy about a pop band working undercover as spies during World War II. You made The Monkeys Nun Keys, in which the boys launch an armed invasion of a convent and lock up all the nuns with magic keys. You even made Chicago and the Chick-Cargo, in which the big-selling US rock group Chicago start a sex trafficking ring, importing hot young women in container ships to pad out their dwindling audiences. What the f*** is wrong with the Bee Gees go to Fiji? Nothing intrinsically, Robin and Barry, but it's the ethnic cleansing subplot that I'm uncomfortable with. Oh, come on, it's not that explicit. Besides, it gives staying alive a whole new dimension lyrically. Not good enough, lads, but I've got this for you. Bee Gees with squeegees. It's a classic car wash flick, soap suds, bikinis and falsetto harmonies. It's perfect for you guys.
Oh, very good.
Thanks, mate. Thanks. That was a morning well spent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Are you a Bee Gees fan, John?
I'm a huge fan of the Bee Gees, Andy. Huge fan.
Say it like you mean it, John.
Living it up when that's on Broadway. So after 5 years of Fiji scouring files in its government departments, it was forced to take the embarrassing step of asking its former colonial masters, us, Andy, for a photocopy. Well, that is very interesting. I'm guessing that we've suddenly lost our copy as well, Andy. We need to make sure that all now our previous colonies have their paperwork in order, because it would be a dream come true if we became the most powerful nation in the world once more due to a series of filing errors.
So Fiji is up for grabs again, and we're delighted to say that we have a special competition this week, given that no one now owns Fiji. Yep. We can offer Fiji, the ownership of Fiji, to you buglers. One of you could win Fiji if you can answer these questions about the 800-plus island-containing state. Question one. Fiji claims to be in Melanesia. What is Melanesia? Is it A, sub-region of the continent of Oceania, comprising thousands of islands in the Western Pacific Ocean? Is it B, a mental condition causing sufferers to forget about large fleshy fruit? Or is it what Mr. and Mrs. Griffith used to say whenever their daughter returned home from school? Melanesia.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Question two. Is this still on?
It shouldn't be. If it is, that's an error on Chris's part.
What does the name Fiji derive from? A, it's an anglicisation of the name of the main Fijian island, Viti-Levu. Is it B, the exclamation uttered by ace British explorer James Cook in the 18th century when told how much he would be charged for harbouring his boat there? Let's have a look at the Fiji! Or is it C, the 18th century... It's named after the 18th century model, actor and actress and socialite Fiona Jeeperswick, the Jennifer Lopez of her day, known as Fiji. Because when Captain Cook first saw the volcanic Fijian islands, he thought that one of them looked like Jeeperswick's famously hefty pair of flippangs, as painted repeatedly by the top-ranking portrait painter of the day, Thomas Gainsborough. Hey, Gainsborough, why don't you ever look at my face? Up a bit more. No, back up a bit. You can't do it, can you, Gainsborough? I'm not a f***ing piece of meat. And no, I'm not two pieces of meat either. And are you painting with that drool? Now put your wig back on your head. You're making me feel queasy and it's not hiding anything. Question three. Who or what is Bainimarama? Is it A, a 1980s British girl band? Is it B, the commander of the Fijian military forces and still interim prime minister of Fiji following a military coup in 2006? Or is it C, an optical device for inspecting randy insects? In particular, woodlice. The woodlice are looking frisky. Better get the Bainimarama out and make sure they're okay. So if you get all those questions correct, and the answers are A, and B, please report to the Fijian capital Suva next Tuesday morning to claim your ownership of Fiji, and do bring your own military force.
Other national identity news now, and a new study has been released by the UK Office of National Statistics about the average British person, Andy. So let's see how you rank. The average British man is 38, will live for another 41 years, and is educated at least at A level. So, you know, you're nearly average, Andy. You're slightly under the curve there, age-wise.
Yep.
And, well, I mean, that's something to look forward to, isn't it? When you hit that sweet spot, Andy, 38, you've got the perfect balance of Britishness.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm the very exemplar of modern Britain.
It goes on to say the average man in England is 5'9" tall and weighs 13.16 stone.
Right.
How'd you rank on that, Andy?
Well, John,
where are you there?
Let's go through these one by one. I'm 36, yep. So I'm just below average.
Yep.
I'm 5'10". So right, I'm fractionally above average.
Just above.
I weigh an average of somewhere between 0 and 20 stone. It's been a while since I measured it, but
yes.
I think that's a fair ballpark.
Yeah.
Although I was educated beyond A-levels,
yes.
to degree level, in fact, I wasn't really paying attention after I left school, so basically I got educated to A-level.
I don't think anyone would disagree.
So the only
that.
Thing I'm not averaging is that I'm not going to live for another 41 years.
Yes.
I'm going to live for another 410.
Yeah, well, also, now it says women living in England or Wales will have an average of 1.96 children during their lifetime. So you're definitely ahead there, Andy, by 0.4 decimal points.
Yeah,
it's not close, four. But a win's a win.
Yeah, I'm ahead by my son's hand.
It also revealed that the five grocery items most likely to be on the average shopping basket are a two-pint carton of semi-skimmed milk, a pack of sliced ham, a box of breakfast cereal, some bacon, and a bar of milk chocolate. Now, you're no stranger to any of those items either, are you, Andy?
Oh, no, not really. No, depends what kind of ham. You know, what are you talking about here? You're talking bog standard supermarket cooked ham? No, that's not in my basket.
The average age to get married in England and Wales was 30.8 for men, 28.8 for women. But the average age for divorce was 36.9 for men.
Shit.
And, well, no, 40.8 for women. Consequently, the typical man remarried at 45.9 compared with 43.1 for women. So that's interesting, Andy. You are just 9 months away from getting divorced and 9 years away from marrying your new 43.1-year-old wife. Spoiler alert. I wish the two of you the best, by the way, Andy.
So what? How are you going to pull? Because you're getting married well beyond your
late.
Best by date.
Way late, Andy. Way late. But it means it does mean I can be married for a lot less time.
Yeah. Well, you're more in showbiz than I am, John, so that kind of makes sense.
That's true. In fact, wow, yeah, I could only be married for a couple of years.
That'd be well above average for Hollywood stars like you. Some other stats that came out of it. The average British man owns one glove, half a hat, and enough scarf to strangle himself. The average British woman doesn't know either what Wally Hammond's test match batting average is or how to build a space rocket.
Well, that's just ridiculous.
Yep, but the average British man knows both of those things. Sorry, I got that wrong. I am a British man and I know both of those things. Sorry, I'm a half British, half man, and I know half of those things. The average British average is now 2% more average than it was in 1997, so that's something for the Blair fans to cling to. And 48% of British people secretly wish they had more legs. 61% of this 48% wanted two more legs. 32% wanted just one more. I don't know what use that is. 6.8% don't know how many, but just know that they definitely want more legs. And 0.2% want 998 more legs. Mostly members of the British Millipede Association. Dreamers. Your emails now, and this one comes in on the subject, Tom. Dear John and Andy, I, like many buglers, was very excited to hear Tom back on the bugle last week.
Mm-hmm.
But he's changed.
Yes.
With blood rushing to his head constantly in that convict-riddled subcontinent.
Yes.
He has obviously lost his understanding of the world.
True.
The main cause from my disgust was when he said, let's bring an end to the F*** you, Chris era. Well, F*** you, Tom. I'm coming after you like the Predator. You're back for one bugle and you start throwing your weight around as if you were soon to be supreme ruler of the known universe, Kim Jong-un. You nothing, Tom. You nothing. Love, Elliot Gallagher. P.S. F*** you, Chris.
I said at the time, yeah. Tom was not in control of this anymore. It's bigger than him now.
Yeah.
And he's wrong to think that he can control it.
Chris, how do you respond to that?
Well, I'm quite looking forward to seeing how Tom reacts to having 6 months of regular internet campaigns against him. it'd be nice. It might take some of the heat off me. It's great.
He's about to reap what he sows.
Because you're pretty much a broken shell of a man these days, Chris, after what people have done to you.
You know, it's a long time since I slept with the lights out.
it's just been tragic to see your decline since you started here.
Maybe this is day one.
Yeah.
Day one of the recovery.
The recovery.
Yeah.
You know, It's got all the makings of a classic feel-good Hollywood movie.
There's an email here from Michael Dore with the subject, Rest Easy About Neuroscience. It says, Dear John and Andy, in descending order of how much your voices annoy my wife.
That's a win for me, isn't it?
I think it is.
Unless his wife is a bitch, in which case, well done, John.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Dore. Contrary to the claims of Joe in Bugle 131, I want to reassure you that the Bugle has not impeded the progress of neuroscience or medicine. I've listened to the vast majority of the 131 episodes and extras of the Bugle while sticking electrodes into slices of mouse brain, which I've recently cut up. I can only... delicious. I could only think of one experiment that I've screwed up directly due to a fit of giggles. Andy's improvised insult to Hosni Mubarak in Bugle 82. That was a good one. I forgot about that. Whereas the joy brought by the Bugle inspired me to substantially improve my productivity. Before the start of the Bugle, I'd published only 4 research papers in a career spanning 9 years, a rate of 0.444 papers per year. In the 3 years since that great day, I've published 3 further papers, more than doubling my productivity. If we factor in that I only started listening by catching up with past episodes in early 2009, my publication rates become 0.38 papers per year pre-Bugle and an impressive 2 papers per year post-Bugle. This cannot possibly be coincidence, and we can extrapolate from that if all scientists in the world listened to the Bugle whilst doing experiments, the rate of scientific discovery would increase more than 5-fold. Michael in Edinburgh. P.S. F*** you, Chris, and f*** you, Tom, too, for being arrogant enough to think you can stop the campaign. That's science. Yep. That's science talking to you there.
Well, so I'm very delighted that the Bugle's been so effective. Maybe it should be used more widely in the scientific community.
Mm.
Yeah. I can only imagine that concentrated bullshit makes people look harder for facts. And that's what science is all about.
Never mind should, Andy. It must. It must be.
Sport! And Wayne Rooney, England's best footballer until he played like a hundredweight of rotting cauliflowers at the World Cup. It's an extraordinary story, John. I imagine it's been front page news stateside.
That's huge.
It appeared that he was agitating for a move away from Manchester United, said that he wanted to leave because the team no longer matched his ambitions, and then a day later signed a new 5-year contract. And it's been, as you can imagine, with this country's ludicrously overinflated enthusiasm for all things football, most of all things that aren't actually football but are people talking about football and who is going to play football for whom. It's been the news story of the, probably even more so than the cuts. People have been much more worried about the future of Wayne Rooney. He now has to go back to the dressing room to the teammates he basically said weren't good enough and say, it's great to be back. Great to be back, fellas. You guys are the best. So for our American listeners who aren't as familiar with Wayne Rooney as the rest of us, here's a Wayne Rooney fact box. Wayne Rooney was born in the shape of a football. His mother had a perfectly spherical womb, and when Rooney popped out, he bounced past the midwife into a stray pair of fishnet tights that one of the doctors had hung up to dry in the birthing suite at Liverpool Hospital in preparation for the hospital production of the Rocky Horror Show. Psychologists think that flying into a net at the age of 0 minutes old is what gave Rooney his unerring eye for goal. As a round baby who required regular inflation with a hand pump through the valve that was his tummy button, Rooney spent most of his first 2 years being kicked around by other kids in impromptu games of street football. The shrinks reckon that whilst this period of his life gave Rooney his preternatural understanding of the geometry of football, 2 years of being literally kicked around also gave him his trademark notoriously short temper and his face. Surgeons began grafting a human body onto the Rooney ball when he was three, using spare parts of retired international footballers who had been put out to stud at the Football Association's footballer breeding farm. Rooney was gradually pieced together. He was given Bobby Charlton's left leg, Jimmy Greaves' right leg, and George Best's Scrumple Stiltskins. From an early age, Rooney was marked out as a special footballer and was nurtured by the FA. He hibernated every summer in a large nest made of goals, was fed special football-themed food, spaghetti a la 25-yard screamer, in which the strings of pasta were in the shape of the parabola of a well-struck free kick. But Rooney was a special player with an even more special temper. As a kid, he was sent off for, amongst other infractions, burying an opposing player alive in the centre circle. "He looked at me," said Rooney, as the ref red-carded him. "Besides, there's nothing in the laws that says you can't bury a player in the centre circle." The buried kid was thankfully kept alive by a friendly family of football-loving worms and was located and dug up safely a couple of years later. But he never played football again and was so scarred by the experience that he refuses ever to walk on the ground. Rooney also hacked down a goalkeeper with a scything two-footed lunge and then said to the ref, "He looks like a pair of socks, ref. I was trying to put him on my feet." And he was also sent off for dousing an opposing defender who just fouled him in salt and vinegar, then charging after him whilst brandishing a pitchfork, shouting, "Come here, chip boy, it's munch time."
Oh, dear.
It's been a long week, John. A long week.
Well, you know, let's just call that a bugle, Andy.
Yeah.
Let's just...
So, I mean, this was the hangover from last week.
It still was.
Save that.
Yeah. Well, that's it. There's going to be no bugle next week.
Yeah, well, that's the forecast. That's the bugle forecast next week. Is there going to be a bugle?
Yeah, the answer is no.
No, that is not going to be an official
that's not
bugle.
So much a bugle as an outright prophecy.
There will be some extras, some offcuts from recent weeks. The stuff that was too good to go out when we recorded it. But John is off doing his rally, and I'm going to be having an absolute hoot at a memorial service.
Yes. So, woo-woo! Yep. Great.
So enjoy your weeks in the meantime, Buglers. And try and plug the bugle at the rally, John. See if you can do that. Massive, great banner. Dangle it down from the stage.
I'll do my best. All right.
Bye-bye, Buglers.
Hey, goodbye, Buglers.
Is this rally going to solve all the world's problems?
Well, if it doesn't, it's been a failure.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's that simple, Andy. Unless it could be a very awkward bugle when we come back in 2 weeks. We'll have nothing really to talk about. See, around this time, it's got everything's very nice, isn't it? Yes. And then we'll do some emails.
Bye-bye, buglers. Hope you have the best weeks of your lives.
Buglers.